will be kind enough to rise and join me in a few moments of silence. Thank you. Before we go on to the meeting, I have a few announcements to make. One of them is you will see the no smoking sign there, and we ask you to please observe that. Thank you. If there are any members of the press present, we would ask them to respect our tradition of anonymity and not to use any of our names. And also, we would like you to know the opinions expressed by the speakers are their own opinions about AA and do not necessarily reflect the AA opinion as a whole. The members of the convention that you will see here who are wearing a third legacy button, you may have seen some of them wearing them like one I have here, will be very happy to answer any questions that you might have about the General Service Conference, which has just taken place. Luncheons and dinners will be served in cafeteria downstairs. The lunch counters and snack bars are on the promenade. They will open at 9 a.m. for juices and sweet rolls and will close 1 hour after the last meeting at night. The lunch counters have a choice of 10 sandwiches, and the snack bars serve hot dogs and cold drinks. Recordings are being made of all meetings, and if you want copies of these recordings, will you please leave your orders at Convention Headquarters, Room B. We are sorry that we couldn't arrange for individuals to use our own tape recorders in the auditorium, but that wasn't possible. It is really a great joy and a pleasure to me to be able to present the chairman this afternoon. She has worked with me at the General Service Headquarters for a number of years. She's my fellow worker and a dear friend. You all know her, I know, as Helen Brown, and you probably also all know that she's recently married and is now Mrs. Jo Moran of San Antonio, Texas. And it's with great pleasure that I turn the meeting over to Helen.
Thank you, Annie. And good afternoon, everybody. I can't think of anything nicer than having Anne introduce me this afternoon, because Anne is the oldest in sobriety or service years at General Service Headquarters. And when I first moved over there from the Boston Intergroup office, Anne and I shared the same office. And believe me, she was a help from the beginning. She's been a staunch and loyal friend. Many of you, I believe, heard her speak this morning. And when I got here and found out that she was to introduce me, I was happier than I can really say. And, of course, I'm very happy with the whole of General Service Headquarters that they're giving me a chance to get up here and spout for 2 minutes. And actually, that's all I'm going to spout for, because I am simply the chairman, leader, master of ceremonies, call it what you will, to introduce some wonderful talkers that we have here this afternoon. The first one is a chap by the name of Dick Breen. Now, Dick has been in AA for more years than I can count, practically, and I'm trying to recall, I think that the first time I met him was in Boston. He sort of been a roving AA. I guess he went in Washington, D.C. originally, and then he's gone up in Maine. I think he's been all over the entire United States. But that's up to Dick to tell you about it. I just want to say that, in my opinion, he's one guy who has certainly done his share in carrying the message of AA, Dick Breen, now of Jackson, Mississippi.
Thank you, Helen. My name is Dick Breen, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very happy to say that I'm very proud that I'm an alcoholic, but much more prouder to say that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think you're going to hear any Patrick Henry speech, or you're not going to hear practically anything new coming from me. I'm just a rowdy bum that found a way to sobriety, and I have one story to tell, and that's mine. There are two things we'll have in common, though, this afternoon. I don't know what I'm going to talk about, and neither do you. But there's one thing you won't do, possibly, like I did when I came into AA, is believe me. And I'm hoping that someday, somewhere, someplace down the line, whether it's here or in Maine or in California or in St. Louis, Missouri, that some guy or gal will believe me. And I hope you will, somebody. Because I had to believe somebody in order to go along with the fellowship, and it took me a long time to believe that these fellows and gals that were up there talking really knew what they were talking about, and the next thing was, were they staying sober? Was it possible to stay sober? So maybe you won't believe me, but that's perfectly all right. Don't let that worry you at all. Because it reminds me of this gal who walked into the bar room, sick, shaky, and on the way by the bartender, she says a double header. She went away down the bar the other side, and she was the only one in there. Long bar, no one there but the bartender and herself. The bartender was very accommodating, run down with a double header and gave it to her. Pretty soon she waved him again, another double header. And pretty soon, she was about to have another one when all at once the voice spoke to her and said, "Would you put me up here on the table, would you? I'd like to talk to you." Have you ever had the whim-whams, DTs, whatever they are that they call them? Well, she thought she had them then. She could hardly reach for the drink, but she did look down, and on the floor was a bullfrog, a big one. And the bullfrog said to her, "Yes, it's me, I'm talking. Will you please put me up on the table? I want to talk to you." So, very reluctantly, she picked up the bullfrog, put it on the table, and he said, "Now, don't be scared. Maybe you won't believe me, but I wasn't always in this position. You see, I was put this way for something that I did years and years and years ago, too long to remember and too long to talk about. But I have a proposition to make to you. If you'll just take me home and put me on your pillow, next to you in your bed this evening, maybe I'll come back to the form that I was in former years. I'm a big, big guy, 6'2", eyes of blue, big brown, wavy hair. Please," he said, "try this experiment." Well, she took the other doubleheader. By that time, she has a pretty good jag on. She buys a bottle, and she takes the frog home, and does just exactly what the frog asked her to do. Well, the next morning, she was awakened by a terrible scream because her loving mother had come into the room and had brought the deer her breakfast. And when she looked into the bed, she threw the tray in the air, and all the dishes smashed on the floor. It awakened the young deer. And screaming, she jumped out of bed. The reason that Mama threw the tray in the air was that there in that bed was a guy 6'2", eyes of blue, brown, wavy, lovely hair. Well, do you know, to this day, no one will believe that girl's story? So why should I bother? I'll get upset if you don't believe mine. Possible, if you ever drank enough. I came in with AA in Washington, D.C. My story of drunkenness wouldn't be any sense of repeating to you. For the simple reason is that if you're an alcoholic, you've been there. But in my story, don't think because I had to crash that I got on that streetcar called alcoholism and went to the end of it and crashed and took everything that a guy could possibly take and had a chance to come back. Don't think that you have to do it. Your story doesn't have to be like mine. In fact, your story isn't like mine. There are no two people in AA that are alike. We're drunkards or alcoholics, whatever you want to call them. But nevertheless, no two people are alike. And my story's my story and nobody else has it. But if I'm going to talk about alcoholism to somebody, it has to be a guy or a gal that understands me. And I'm sure that there are hundreds and thousands in this town today that know exactly what I'm talking about. Why? Because they've been there. And if they haven't been there, they'll never know what I'm talking about anyway. But nevertheless, I had to go the whole distance. And this is the town that I didn't want to come back to. This is the town where I finally took my last crash and made up my mind that from here in, there's only one place that I want to associate with people. There's only one place that I can live, because up for 40-odd years of my age, then, in 1938, I was always sick and tired of people telling me how to drink, why to, when to drink, how much to drink. It was my money, my life. What I did with it was my business, not anybody else's. And finally, in 38, I made the Bowery right here in St. Louis, right from the Wilcox Oil and Gas Company. There are a lot of things that I'd hate to see in St. Louis today. There are a lot of memories that I don't want, but they're there, and I can't throw them away. And I started my rounds of the Bowery's right from here. A beaten out, licked, Irish bum. How often I've been told that. How often I've been told that sooner or later you'll reach that point, Green. Yeah, I'd been thrown out of schools, I'd lost jobs, I'd got up, I'd got down, I'd made money, I'd lost it. But finally I made the decision on my own. And there's one thing that I knew, that when the going got too rough, when the time came for me to leave this earth, I thought I had the intestinal fortitude, or guts, whatever you wish to call it, to take my own life and to stop that suffering. I've seen man's inhumanity from to man. I've slept in the snow, I've been hungry, I've been left for dead, I've been beaten, and I know all the stories that go along with it. But I thought the time would come, and it did come. In the fall of 40, November, in the Caribbean Sea on a tanker, the only reason I took it, because I knew myself, I thought, oh, I was so smart. And I knew one night when I wanted to go over that rail, when I wanted to dump into the Caribbean, that's all there'd be to it, because even my own family, brothers and sisters, would rather have a skunk come to their door than me, and today I couldn't blame them for it. And one night in the Caribbean, I tried it. And that's the first time I honestly cried, when I lost my guts to leave. I came back into Boston, the town that Helen's talking about now. And I went from there all over the country again, and finally in a jail in Virginia. And I tell this story because I know it's true, and I know there's no certain way you can bring a man into AA. And I think that anything that you say from your heart or any honest effort that you make is the right thing to do. There is no set way or any set rule that you're going to change a man's life. You're not that big, and neither am I. I never sobered a man up in my life, and nobody in this auditorium ever sobered a man up in their lives, but a program called Alcoholics Anonymous did. And finally, a bum, like myself, in a prison in Virginia, told me of somebody picking him up in the park, how they were kind to him, how they dressed him up, how they showed him a way to sobriety. I was still the smartest guy in the world, because he's in jail with me, and he's in jail for drunkenness, the same as I was. And I ridiculed him. In fact, I wouldn't even get off the bus with him when we arrived in Washington a few days later. One night in August, August 30th to be exact, of 1941, I had beriberi, malnutrition, and I was on my way out, and I knew it. I couldn't do it the easy way, I had to do it the hard way. And a friend of mine, God bless him, I hope he's in heaven, he's given me the 14 years of my life that I can't forget or ever want to forget or ever will forget. Because he sent me up to AA to bum enough money to get a quart of whiskey. I must have been fairly good even in those days, because I did walk up to this place. He told me that a fellow I knew that was director of the Billy and Loan Association that I was formerly manager of in Washington some years before, was up there, and he was president of a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And the guy was preaching to drunks. It was a glorified mission house. And when he sees you, he'll give you enough for a couple of bottles, I know. Well, I didn't care who it was or why. I went up there. And I found a group of people, a group of men and women just like myself, but I didn't know it. All I was looking for was that same thing that I'd been looking for 25 years. I was looking for a bottle. All my life was around a bottle, situated around a bottle, had to come out of a bottle. And fortunately, there was a guy there that night that gave me enough of dough to go out and get enough of bottles. Some of them that are in the audience here tonight remember. One of them especially, a gal, and another guy, and a few more of them. And I walked out of there ridiculing those bunch of missing stiffs. And went down, and what did I do? The same thing. I got drunk. I laid in the gutter, and I got up in the morning again for the same thing that I'd been doing for years, to get up to get another drink to get drunk again. And for some reason, that night, I went back at 6 o'clock. It was a little bit before 6, and I was right in the place here now. He was secretary of the group then. The club wasn't open. And that night, I became what is known as a clubroom guy. You either is or you ain't. A clubroom where you fight it out. A clubroom that brings in a guy like myself that you wouldn't dare to bring into a home or a private place. An open clubroom where you can sit you down, pat you on the back, and thank you for walking in the door instead of throwing out and condemning you. And I walked in that door and got that kind of a reception for the first time in years upon years. And I'll never forget that night, because there were guys and gals there that understood what I was talking about. Even though I was at death's door and I knew there wasn't a chance in the world for me or my sobriety, it was all right for you, but not for me. I'd gone too far. I'd crashed on that streetcar, and there was no coming back. I'd seen men try it before, and I'd seen women try it before. They hadn't done a very good job about it. But somehow, somewhere, someplace, something hit. You don't know what it is, and neither do I. Merely your opinion, just like mine. But they sent me out for a drink, and I didn't take it. I took a little stew and came back. And I sat there, wondering and listening. And a guy named Bill, in fact, two guys named Bill, not Wilson, but two other Bills, were in there that night. Guys I drank with, guys that I kicked it around with. And both of those boys patted me on the back and sent me down to a flop house that night with the last quarter that they had. And the next morning I slipped into a park on 14th Street, behind the bushes where I could die. For some reason, I don't know, I didn't. Why, I'll find out someday, but that doesn't make any difference now. And I went back up to that club room September 1st, 1941, and I haven't had a drink since. I tell that story because if a guy like myself can do it, anybody can do it. I still claim there isn't an alcoholic alive in this world today who is fighting that fight that an alcoholic has to fight, that lonesomeness, that humiliation, that death day by day that isn't looking for a way out. And it looks like today there's one place he can find it. Oh, there are other ways to get sober. I'm talking about a happy way of getting sober. I know of a lot of people that have sobered up by themselves, and the only question that I can ask them is, who did you ever give it to? And the answer is nobody. So by yourself, you haven't done so well. I couldn't stay sober by myself. There are other men that have, but they kept it for themselves. But finally, I found a fellowship of men and women who didn't want to keep it to themselves, who wanted to give it away. And I sat around that club room for days and for weeks and for months, listening to men and women just like you, and trying and trying and trying to believe them. They're talking about an honest desire. My honest desire was nothing. I just wanted a way out, someplace, somehow. And here it came. And men and women like you gave it to me. And all over the country, then I've traveled and I've seen men and women just like you. I've seen clubs start and go and go down and up again. And I've seen this glorious fellowship grow. We, not I, we together. We together will stay together and make it what it is today and build it from here in, or individually we'll ruin it. There's only one way we can keep it together, and that is we, not I. Oh, it's been a gift to me for guys and gals that I know out there and all over the country. And how can I thank you? How can I say, and what could I say? Thank you, Bill. Yeah. Thank you, Lois. Thank you, Doc, and thank you, Ann. And thank you for guys and gals just like you. And my only wish is that you'll be sober from here in. God bless you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dick. The years are becoming on you. I told you that he'd been sober more years than I could count, but I had a pencil and paper here, and I figured it out, so now I know. And I've heard Dick talk before, and each time that he has, and that I've had the privilege of hearing him, I have gotten something out of it to take home with me. And the particular thought that I think I'll carry away from his message today is that we, not I, business. Because it is we of Alcoholics Anonymous, who are going to, with God's help, continue to carry on and to bring AA to the people who haven't yet been fortunate, as have we, to come to this movement. You know, I don't believe I said that I'm an alcoholic, but I am. And it's rather difficult sometimes to explain to you exactly what goes on inside of a woman when she is a practicing, active alcoholic. It's about the most degrading, awful thing in your life.